Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie.
Hi, I'm Isabel and I'm an addict. And I have to say this is truly daunting. I actually didn't know what a speaker meeting was. I'm in recovery a long time, and I thought a speaker meeting just meant not a step meeting, not a traditional meeting, not a something else meeting. I hadn't realised that it was just speaking, and for a very long time, and with so many people, so it's practically a convention, which is rather terrifying. I'll try and talk you through just why I'm here and my recovery. I came to NA in the early 80s, and I was taken there by a cousin of mine who was in recovery. And I was still quite young. I had started using young. And I was a pretty hopeless addict, to be fair. I had been using smack since the age of 13. And I had constantly done it really just more as a form of medication. I wasn't even really looking for a fantastically good time. What I was trying to do was sort of make myself balanced. I've been very unbalanced pretty much always. I can't really explain why. I come from a large family. Everything is was really quite comfortable, and yet I always felt wrong. I told lots of lies from a very early age. I was in fantasy land. I would create all sorts of fantasies. And I would carry out some of them. I mean, there'd be moments where I'd decide that I was dumb, literally physically dumb. So I would not speak for, long periods of time. I would decide that, I couldn't see things properly. I had, was just generally trying out all sorts of things. And so people would, at school be concerned about this. I claimed my family were Maoris and I was deposited with the family that I was with. I had, I'm one of six children and five girls, and we all went to the same school. So, every lie I told was virtually bound to be found out. And I was an incredibly bad liar. But I just never felt that I was right or that my family was right or, I was right in it. And I was constantly experimenting with things. So I have an older brother who I remember telling me that, if you took aspirin and drank Coca-Cola and stood on your head, that actually you would get out of it. So that's what I did. We used to have junior aspirin, and I took the whole bottle, and I took Coca-Cola, and I couldn't breathe. And that's what happened. But I was just not very deterred by that. I was constantly trying different things. And I wasn't frightened of smack. My brother had was taking it, and I thought it was incredibly cool. They seemed to be having a really good time and a lot of fun. So I started doing that, and I was taking speed. I also had a problem with anorexia and body image, and I just, everything about me was wrong. I looked wrong. I wasn't the person I wanted to be. I was constantly going from one obsession to another obsession. I read a lot as well, which was kind of odd, and I was always in trouble at school. I was always the naughty one. And so I was weirdly quite popular, which is kind of odd given that I was so strange. But I think it was because I was quite daring, and I was much younger than everybody else in my year, so that was also part of it. And anyway, I ended up being sectioned for having this problem with anorexia. And after that, my drug taking took off big time. And really, it helped me. I mean, taking smack was like, I loved it from the off. I mean, there was no sort of messing around. I just thought, oh, what a relief. I now don't have to think. I don't have to worry about who I am or what I'm doing or where I am or where I'm going or anything else. That's all that, I have to do. And I really wasn't very concerned about it. And it was slightly secretive because obviously there were Lots of friends of mine who weren't doing that, or they were taking, you know, they were smoking pot, which never really appealed to me very much. I tried it, but didn't particularly like it. Didn't stop me using it, but I didn't use it very often. And I had tried drink, generally drunk far too much, threw up, which was quite lucky because, you know, the weight worries. So, you know, and I drink didn't naturally fit with what I wanted to do, given that I had concerns about weight. And so heroin was just, you know, the dream drug for me. But I did take lots of other things. And when I was 15 and I was sitting my what were then called O-levels and now GCSEs, I thought, oh, God, if I'm, you know, stuck somewhere for quite some time, maybe I should get a script. So I got scripted, age 15. And I got busted that same year as well. And actually, I was let off. I told them a big sob story about how, you know, my home was, you know, pretty difficult. It was a ridiculously comfortable existence, actually. But and I was very worried that they would come. But fortunately, everyone else was much older than me. And so I got let off. And I always looked slightly like butter wouldn't melt. So that made my life much easier. And I kept going on. But I used to OD all the time. I could never really have limits. So a lot of people didn't really want me to use with them because they felt that obviously it was, you know, not great having somebody ODing in their house. So I ended up with more and more isolated in my using. And I did a lot of watching TV and videos. We were one of the first people to have videos, so I did that a lot of the time. And I did have two other siblings who were using, so that was quite good. I had a sort of sugar daddy type person who would score for me, look after me, use. And he had other people who he'd had. In fact, I was the only one of his relationships like that, in fact, who remained alive, who got recovery. So the two people that immediately preceded me as his sort of, you know, people that he would look after had both died and died young. And when I did travel a bit. I went to Russia. Well, it was then the Soviet Union. And I thought, you know, it would be a good idea and, you know, it would make life harder. And I would look really straight. I had no idea what looking really straight was. And I was sort of punky at the time. I also thought that I couldn't actually, I needed to take something with me in case it took me time to work out how to school. So I actually took a lot of drugs with me. I mean, you know, now looking back, I just so often think, there but for the grace of God. I mean, it's so amazing to me. And I did get stopped, and they searched my case because I looked so odd. You know, I was really skinny. I was a punk, which they weren't used to. I was trying to look so conservative that I had... Do you remember the period of sort of baggy trousers? I had those kind of baggy trousers and strange things on and DNs. And, anyway, they stopped me. And they went through my case, and it was a really panic-making. And I'd actually put all my packets in... sanitary towels and glued them back together. And fortunately, they didn't go through them. So I was incredibly, incredibly lucky. And it didn't take me long anyway to score out there because the Afghanistan war was going on. So that was a real help. And there were also quite a lot of Americans with Quaaludes and things like that. So, you know, wherever I went, I did manage to score. And I got myself into so many dangerous situations, but I never really thought very much about the dangers. I mean, you know, I just would move on to the next thing. You know, I'd score in places. I had so many dirty hits. I mean, I really didn't care about... Where I went, what I did. I was always, you know, just an accident waiting to happen. And again, ODing frequently. So, real problem. And in the end, this cousin of mine said, you've got to go to a meeting. So he took me to this meeting. And at the time in NA, there weren't even meetings every day. And it was a meeting on a Thursday in end of the King's Road. And there was a girl there who I know very well, and she was doing the chair, and the only two things that I identified with her with, and now, you know, practically everything she says I can identify with, one was that she'd had anorexia, and the second thing was she hated Christmas. None of the using part, none of the how she got clean, none of the anything did I identify with. And I saw an old friend there, and we had a sponsored slip with the pot. And I just thought, well, you know, it only goes to show that they aren't really clean, these people. And that's what I, you know, I did. Anyway, a month later, I went to another meeting taken by somebody else who just got clean. And I OD'd in the loos there. And I got put in treatment. And I said, no, I'm really busy. I've got very important things to do and I can't stay. And I went back to live in Paris where I'd been living so that I wasn't too close to my family. And I used to get lots of money from my mother for furniture and all sorts of things, you know, and I was... And I was living on, you know, I had a mattress on the floor, I had tars. I really thought she was being so overdramatic when she came into treatment, when I was finally got into treatment, and was saying how upset she'd been to go to my flat. Because she'd envisaged that I had, you know, curtains that I'd spent, you know, she'd spent thousands of pounds on all these things that I didn't have, and blood-stained walls and things like that. And she was rather sort of, you know, horrified. And I just thought, oh, God, it's all about her, you know. No tolerance for how I made her feel, for how the things that I did affected other people. I just couldn't see it. I thought it's about me, poor me, my life's really difficult, my life's really tough. Anyway, somebody came over to Paris and decided to 12-step me, and or rather 13-step me, and then drove me into treatment in England. And I landed up there, and I was rather relieved, actually, to be there, on one hand, because life had been incredibly isolated. I was very lonely, and I felt as though I was a sort of old person trapped in a young person's body. I was 18 at the time, and I felt as though I was kind of destined to live my life out for however much longer. I had no idea. I would have been really happy to have died, but I wasn't really prepared to do anything much about it. I didn't really do proper suicide attempts. And I just thought, God, this is a relief. But within 2 minutes of being there, I was on euphoric recall with people. Oh, no, it was great. Everything was wonderful. You know, I just couldn't, you know, I really struggled with it. I also had a lot of denial about my part in things because I always assumed that it was everybody else doing it to me. There was a lot of other people getting drugs for me and other people doing things for me. So what was rather unfortunate was that the counsellor that I had told me that there was a trainee counsellor that was showing up 3 days later and he was going to attend our sessions. And not knowing who it was, I said, no, that's fine. Turned out it was somebody who used to be my dealer when I was 14, 15. So that wasn't very helpful for being able to explain how none of this was my fault and it was all other people. And there was part of me that wanted recovery. But I think the reality was I didn't think I was worth it. That was the biggest part. I didn't really think I was worth it. I didn't think I was just an addict. I thought I was mad. You know, the insanity bit on step two, actually, you know, I knew I was mad. I mean, I was really quite mad. And I thought that nothing that I did was going to make it better. So if, you know, this didn't work, then it was really obvious that nothing would, if I tried it. I was incredibly self-conscious. And I also thought that it was a really raw deal that I might have, you know, 40 years of recovery to have to live out, or 60 years of recovery. And there were some people who were quite old there who didn't have to last very long in this recovery thing, you know, like 60. So they only had to sort of get through however many years. So I thought it was much harder for me. And I also thought I was more sensitive than other people. Some days I thought I was far better than other people. I never really had a problem compared to them. Other days I thought I was much worse. I thought I was really intelligent, and so all these simple things were not going to work for me. I really needed a sort of, you know, a man in a white coat with German accent and big, heavy tones, you know, to sort me out. And after 10 months, I came back to London, and shortly after, I started using again. And then I OD'd, I ended up in hospital, I went back to treatment. I found my man with a German accent and white coat. He was an amazing man called Dr. Glatt, who was working in a recovery treatment centre, and he was wonderful. And I had one more go of using, and I OD'd and I got sectioned back in the place that I'd been in all those years ago for other things. And I just thought, oh my God, I can't stay clean and I can't use. I really don't know how to do this. I'm just not able to do, you know, to live. And after a month when I got out, I went to a meeting, a different Thursday meeting to that first one. And it was a relatively small meeting, and it was sitting in a circle. And it went, everybody shared, and then there was like 10 minutes left, and I hadn't shared. And I was already feeling rather bitter about the whole thing, because people were laughing in the meeting, and I was obviously in a lot of pain, so I thought that was very insensitive. And finally, the guy kept saying, you know, have you got anything to say? And so I said, you know, I've just come out from being sectioned, I can't use and I can't stay clean. I really don't know how to do it. And he came back in and said, that was the moment that I got recovery, when I didn't know how to do it anymore. And that was true for me. Because actually, up until that point, I had so many reservations. You know, I definitely didn't want to do the God bit. God was like mortifyingly embarrassing. I didn't want to be keen, and so there were all these people that would sit in the front, and they were really keen. I thought that was deeply uncool. you know, I had so many ideas about what I was and wasn't going to do, and how I was and wasn't going to recover. And, you know, actually, I wasn't even aware of having half these reservations. And so I thought, okay, I will just do what I'm told, and I will try and see. And every day, I was yearning to use. And normally I had no frustration level. This is what the German doctor identified, no frustration level. You know, I would intend to stay clean, but something tiny would go wrong and I'd just go, oh, fuck it, I might as well be using. And go off and use. And then the whole thing would start again. And I would just cling on. I got a sponsor. I got a really terrifying sponsor. I thought that's kind of what I needed, somebody who I was frightened of. And I would work the steps, and I would go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And amazingly, on about something like 26 days, I suddenly woke up and realised that I hadn't thought about wanting to use for the last however long, for, you know, about 3 hours or something. But that was quite miraculous, actually, because it had been a real struggle. I had been told to get a job when I'd gone into treatment. And I decided to get a job on the shop floor of M&S because I was told I needed humility. And I thought, well, if I don't get humility in a nylon uniform, I can really give up any hope of getting humility. But the really useful thing about getting a job straight away was it was something that I had to do every single day. You know, I had to get up and show up. And, you know, the thing which now, thinking about it, I find so extraordinary. Then, getting through a day, what do you do if you're not using? If you're not using and scoring and gouching out in front of the TV. I mean, it was just, there were all these hours and I just simply didn't know how to deal with them. So having to go to work just helped a lot. And even the thought that I had to ring up and explain why I wasn't going to be there if I wasn't, or that they might ring up, just meant that I just thought, you know what, it's easier just to get there. And suddenly, it just helped me get through. Because I wasn't naturally the kind of person that did what I was told. They'd said, don't be in a relationship. When I left my first treatment centre, I come in a relationship with somebody. I left in a relationship with somebody else. So that wasn't very helpful. And I stayed in that relationship for about 2 years. I was told by the counsellor probably not to change anything at that point because I'd struggled so much with getting clean. And finally, I got to the point, and you know, I know the person still today, and I do love him, but we weren't right for each other. And I finally realised that I needed to be on my own if I was going to really recover, because I didn't have to make that much of an effort to talk to people. One of the things that I hadn't understood when I was slipping and sliding, and when I was when I'd slipped just before finally getting clean, this guy showed up at my flat who was in recovery, and he went, "Look, you know, come on, you've just got to do it." And I said, "But you don't understand, it's harder for me. You know, I'm really frightened. I go to meetings with people who go, yes, I really identify with you. I'm really frightened too of sharing or of talking to people of whatever." And then they're talking to people, you know, and he goes, "Yeah, but you have to do it in spite of the fear." It's like, well, that's really, you know, it never occurred to me that they were doing it in spite of being frightened. I was waiting for the fear to lift before I could do things. And I found I was so incredibly self-conscious. I mean, you know, you were talking before about walking past people. I mean, if somebody shared near me, I would go red and I would start shaking. I would be desperate for the loo. I couldn't get up and go to the loo because people might look at me. You know, it was just so painful, that sort of total self-consciousness. I found it really difficult. And because I live with my boyfriend, his sister and her boyfriend, who are in recovery, I didn't have to make that much effort. So there were lots of people in recovery that I knew because I'd used with or I'd been in treatment with, but I didn't make that much effort to really get a good support system. And so finally, when I left this person, I did. And my boyfriend had, in fact, been very helpful in pushing me to get another job, because another pattern in my recovery is I take one step and, you know, that worked, okay, great, and I don't want to take the next step ever. I really am not naturally sort of into taking risks. I was so frightened that things would go wrong. And he pushed me to get a job that was sort of more challenging for me. And I've more or less been doing that ever since, which, again, doesn't sound like I've been taking lots of big risks in my life, but it's quite, it has progressed a bit within it. And I do a job where I have to, you know, travel around the world and do things, and I'm deemed to be quite responsible and all those kinds of things, and in charge of quite a lot of money. I mean, it all seems rather extraordinary. I then also eventually found somebody that I fell in love with. And that was pretty miraculous for me, because I'd never, ever thought about being with somebody. I never thought that I was worth it. So somebody would come up to me and say, you know, what I describe as, "Me Tarzan, you Jane." And I go, "Oh, all right then." And I would just go off with them. I would never think, do I want to be with this person? Do I like this person? Do I any... It was just sort of, okay, great, somebody wants me. You know, it was kind of the relief of that. And so suddenly to want to be with somebody was a huge deal for me, and it felt very risky and very kind of worrying. And I think I liked them more than they liked me. Well, eventually we got married, and we've been married now 25 years, which seems pretty amazing. And what's helpful is he had lots of friends who were addicts and in recovery, but he wasn't an addict. And he wasn't really interested in me being an addict. And what was quite useful about that was I still partly clung to the fact that in recovery I was boring, and when I was using, I was fun. I mean, fun, really, you know, ODing fun, you know, kind of boring, whiny, kind of self-absorbed, you know, self-piteous. But I still had the notion, because dramas happened and things happened and there were lots of kind of war stories, that I was somehow more interesting when I was using. And I was boring when I was in recovery. And I think what was quite useful was that he wasn't interested, and in fact didn't want me particularly. It wasn't that he was frightened of my stories or, you know, I just found it irritating and not interesting. And it was really helpful, because then I could really inhabit the sort of person who was in recovery. And it made a big difference, I think, to me. And of course, in work, nobody knew I was an addict. And again, for that period, I was inhabiting a person who wasn't in recovery. So I stopped feeling like I had addict written all over my forehead, that everybody knew I was an addict, that I probably should be walking around the street waving a bell going, unclean, unclean, you know, that I was sort of just a normal person. A lot of people didn't realise I wasn't normal, which was pretty extraordinary. And I think that was a huge change for me. I started working the steps, and a step four, for those of you that have done it or are thinking about doing it, was a huge, huge deal for me. I'd done one in treatment, and it had not been particularly, you know, one way or the other. But when I did it when I was about 3 years clean, what was fantastic was I suddenly could see all the patterns of behaviour that were my patterns. So all this thing about me having been a victim of other people. In fact, they were all my patterns. There would be different people, different situations, but the only common thing was me and that everything fucked up. You know, everything was a mess at the end of it. And I could suddenly see that I didn't want to be that person anymore. I didn't want to be the sort of this self-piteous, self-absorbed person. I did, you know, they weren't kind of charming or interesting or endearing or anything else traits. They were actually depressing and boring and dull and led to one thing. And I felt very motivated to want to change. And I think that was another big godsend for me. I struggled a lot with really basic things in early recovery. I struggled a lot with how to deal with basic things like eating because of having had a problem with it. So I just made rules for myself, which might sound very anal, but actually they helped me hugely. So I thought I would only eat if I was sitting down with a knife and fork. Whatever it was, I would sit down and eat because it was just much more straightforward. And I accepted that I had no idea. If I looked in a mirror, I looked like a house, and that might not be what I really looked like to other people. So I would weigh myself. I agreed a weight as to what was reasonable, and if I was getting a few pounds lighter, I would allow myself more, and if I was getting a few pounds heavier, I would try and stick within a thing. And it made me feel safe that I didn't need to sort of do anything more than that. So I had certain things like that. I would get up, I would try and hand it over, and I didn't have, you know, and I would get to regular meetings and I would talk to my sponsor. But just these few things. And praying, I haven't been amazing at praying, but except for the Serenity Prayer. The Serenity Prayer has been huge in my life from day one, because the one thing that I find I can do really easily, and I was doing it rather a lot, actually, whilst I was sitting here before, is I say, you know, what can I do something about? Okay, I could do something about this. What can't I do something about? And then try and hand it over. And that, I haven't progressed to some massive understanding of serenity. I'm not very sort of Buddhistic, touchy-feely. I'm somebody who is naturally very obsessive. And so the best way I've been able to achieve balance, I think, is by doing a lot of things so that you actually cram a lot of things in and therefore you're not just overly doing one thing, which doesn't sound very kind of spiritual, I think. But I work, I have my kids, I go to meetings, I have my charity, I do exercise each week, I've got cultural things that I like doing, I like going to the theatre and cinema and things like that. And that helped me enormously. I mean, that's another thing. I mean, this doesn't sound very spiritual, but I felt so boring when I came into recovery. And I felt the only things I could talk about were using or treatment, or kind of meetings. I just thought, I don't know about anything else, and I felt kind of really alien. And so one thing that helped me was reading newspapers, and suddenly thinking, actually, I really care about this issue, or God, I really want to read that book, or I really want to do something. And I suddenly felt connected. Initially, I just connected to people in recovery, when I finally accepted I was an addict and I might recover. And then I started feeling connected to more things that were going on around me. And now I honestly do feel like I'm part of the human race. I don't feel like I'm an alien human being. And I feel hugely, hugely grateful. I've been given an awful lot. I mean, I had to turn my life around a bit, my thinking around, because for me the instinct was to be incredibly negative about everything I had. I didn't look the way I wanted to, I wasn't as bright as I wanted to be, I wasn't as, you know, interesting or funny or as anything as I wanted to be. And I was so focused on what I wasn't and who I wasn't. And I had to work out that I was enough. Everything I had was enough in order to recover and to be happy. And that made a huge difference. So what I had to start doing was learning to be grateful for what I had. So I started writing gratitude lists. And I think it's a bit like exercise. You know, if you exercise a particular muscle, you know, initially it's really hard and then it just gets normal. And I knew I didn't want to be this kind of self-piteous person anymore. In fact, the very first treatment centre I went to, for the one for 10 months, there was one of the counsellors who told me about a self-pity group for the most self-piteous people in the treatment that he'd been in. And they would meet in a gym, and they would it was kind of in a basement, so it was particularly gloomy. And they would all sit around saying, you know, things like, I saw you smile yesterday, happy little soul, aren't you? And then another one would say, somebody talked to you, nobody talked to me. And that was the kind of thinking that I had, but I so didn't want to identify with those kinds of people. I just knew I didn't want to be the person sitting in that self-pity gym. And I taught myself how to learn to be grateful for the things that I had by writing these gratitude lists and learning to be grateful for the things I had. And amazingly, as that happened, I think what happens is you find it easier to see the positive. And the more you see the positive, the more positive things happen to you. When I had my children, I thought that was the moment. I was always expecting something to come and slip me up, because I knew that I was mentally unstable, so therefore, you know, inevitably something would slip me up. It was all going too well. And I would probably have postnatal depression, or I would probably, something terrible would happen. And nothing, miraculously, did happen. Initially, it took me a long time to get pregnant, and I thought, well, that's it. You know, that was probably because of my using and all of that. And that's been miraculous for me, having children. It's been extraordinary. They're now, one will be 19 this month, and the other will be 21 at the end of August. And, I mean, you know, it seems incredible to me. I mean, one of them may be an addict, I don't know. She's, the younger one, is in a phase where she does drink quite a lot and she smokes dope quite a lot. But actually, she's a really nice person. She's really funny and bright. And she actually does think about other people, which, you know, I was quite incapable of. So I cling to these rather positive things in the hope that she won't be. But I have to accept my powerlessness and that, you know, she may or may not be. And, I knew people that used smack and stopped and actually have done okay. And they taught me a lot about being generous, because, you know, I would screw up, and I was always so hard on myself when I screwed up. I would always feel, right, well, there's no point in me even living, actually, you know. I mean, I remember a very early discussion with my husband. You know, I said that he was quite keen on me being the better self, and I sometimes sort of explain, very early on in our marriage, I was hanging paintings on the wall, and I'm really useless at anything practical. So I was drilling, and I said, is it straight? And because it wasn't, he said, no. Well, I didn't hear, no, it wasn't straight. I just heard, you're useless, you might as well not bother living, or it might as well die, and I really don't want to be married to you. So I went into a complete drama, as I always had. And he said, it's not straight. If you want me to do it, then I'll do it. If you don't want me to do it, that's fine. And he didn't kind of bury me deeper. And my children were always incredibly generous. You know, I'd often drive in the wrong direction or do the wrong thing, and I'd go, I'm really sorry, we're going to be late for your best friend's party. And they'd go, oh, that's okay, don't worry. You know, they were so generous. I was so hard on myself, and I actually was hard on them. If they dropped something, what are you doing? You know, and I've had to learn how to be generous to them, to other people, and to myself. And so that's taught me huge amounts. And I do feel incredibly grateful. I'm probably not the person. I've had to accept a lot of things about myself that I would rather not. I'm not cool. I'm never going to be cool. I'm actually what I term emotionally incontinent. I cry incredibly easily over nothing. You know, put on the TV news and they say there's starvation in the third world. I'm in tears. I cry in books. It doesn't help that I stopped smoking, which actually did used to help, because by the time I got the cigarette out, when things were getting a bit emotional and lit it and hunted around, it would kind of dampen it all down. Now I don't smoke, so that doesn't really help me with that. So I've just had to accept that that's who I am. But actually, I'm happier than I've ever been, and I feel that I've got a very full life, which I never dreamt that I would have. I have work that I find interesting and amazingly pays me a really decent amount. And everything that I have, I've got through coming to meetings and working the steps and through people like you. So I can only say thank you very much for being here, and I'm immensely grateful to the program. Thanks.